Last week, we read chapter 27, and I pointed out that the last half of that chapter sounds so much like Job's friends that several commentaries, including Erdman, which my wife has here, they propose that the last half of chapter 27 is possibly Zophar's third and final speech, because Zophar doesn't speak but two times. And they propose that there's possibly a textual error there, else Job appears to contradict himself. The problem is this. In chapter 20, Zophar says to Job, here's what God does to the wicked. He takes away their children. He takes away their wealth. He makes them suffer miserably before they die. In 21, Job says, no, God doesn't do that. He's refuting what he says in 20. He says, the wicked have their children happily around them. They prosper. They grow old without suffering, and they die peacefully. So in chapter 21, Job is refuting what Zophar says. Now this is my explanation, okay, for what it's worth. This is the way I explain away the apparent contradiction. Now when you get to 27, where Job says he says, here's what God does to the wicked. He takes away their children, takes away their wealth, and he makes them suffer miserably before they die. It says exactly what Zophar says in verse 20, chapter 20. So that's the apparent contradiction. And I said last week that I didn't like the idea of a textual error, but I also had not heard of a good explanation that would allow Job to say what we read in chapter 27, verses 11 through 28. I think I got a reasonably good explanation. It satisfies me anyway, so I thought I'd share it with you before we get to chapter 28. Going back to what, you remember what we said last week, we had up on the board, we had Job's friends are arguing from the position in the debate that God always punishes the wicked. He never rewards the wicked. Okay, that's what Zophar said. So their position in their argument is it's an always and never position. God always does this. He never does that. Okay? And I pointed out that that's an easy position to defeat in any debate. Usually you can defeat that position easily because all you got to do is find a counterexample. Okay? So, but they're convinced that they know what God is doing. God is punishing Job, and that's the reason he's suffering. So like I said, in 21, Job refutes that position from chapter 20. Even in 24, he even says God not only leaves the wicked person's children with him and never takes away his wealth and never punishes him. Sometimes the righteous suffer at the hands of the wicked, and God doesn't do anything about it. That's what he says in chapter 24. But in chapter 27, I believe that Job is confirming that God does indeed punish the wicked sometimes. Okay? He's referring to what he said earlier in 21. He will never admit that, I'm sorry, earlier in 27. And he said, I'll never admit that I'm wicked. I'll never agree with you that I'm wicked, because he gives two reasons why. He says, they have no hope when God cuts them off. Well, that says that God's going to cut them off, right? And they have no hope beyond the grave, and they have no delight in God. That's what he says in chapter 27, before he repeats what Zophar says. So in 21, he's refuting Zophar. In 21, he's confirming that God does, there is a divine retribution from God.
And 27, you mean?
27. Did I say 21 again?
Yeah.
I get mixed up. Does that make sense? That's the best explanation I can come up with. if he refutes his friends, he appears to be taking exactly the opposite side of the debate. In other words, they say God always punishes the wicked and never rewards them. He's not saying the exact opposite of that. He's not saying God never punishes the wicked. He's saying sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. So,
well, when Job says that when God cuts you off, he's an either or right there. He's a when.
Yeah.
I think he may be saying that in my case, he has cut me off.
Yeah, I think he feels that's his complaint, is that in his case, God's been unjust to him.
But he's not saying in every case God's going to cut you off.
No. Well, I think he said that eventually the wicked will pay for their sins. Okay? So it's his argument is sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes God does this, sometimes God doesn't do that. So he's not arguing the exact opposite of their position in the debate. So you have to keep a real clear understanding of the two sides of the debate in the for the last 30 chapters, okay? If he said that God always rewards the wicked and never punishes the wicked, then he would be arguing from the point of view that God is not good and God is not just, right? And you don't want to do that.
Well, the way he does it, it maintains the sovereignty of God.
Mm-hmm.
He decides, and you don't know the mind of God complete, of course.
Okay. Sounds like Job is straddling the fence.
Yeah, he is. And I think we straddle the fence.
Oh, yeah.
We
do. A lot.
Don't we do that? We say God's going to punish the wicked, but we see them all around us and they're not being punished. So, and that, you know, remember from one of the videos we saw, or the audio, Job is all over the place in this debate. He's mad, he's upset and everything, so... So I conclude that if he had not said that, he would have been contradicting his side of the debate. He would have been saying God's always rewarding the wicked. So that's my explanation. I'm not sure I did explain it to you very well, but Becky brought me a book from Jack on Job by Jim McGuigan. A lot of you know Jim McGuigan. I haven't read it yet, but I just thumbing through the introduction. He refers to chapter 27, and he says Job is confirming his conviction that God's has a divine retribution. There is a divine justice ultimately that the wicked will pay. So I conclude there is no contradiction. He either has to contradict himself in the debate, or he has to contradict himself in what he just said in 21. So. That's my explanation for what it's worth, okay? Does that make sense? Okay. I think of it this way. The three friends are always and never. They say, they're always and never guys. And Job is sometimes yes, sometimes no. He doesn't take a side opposite of theirs. So that makes sense to me that he can say what he says in 27 and what he says in 21 and not contradict himself that badly, okay? I want to make another point. You know, I said last week that I've got 70 translations of the Bible on my phone, okay? You can, Bible app, it's a standard Bible app. But I said I speculated there's probably some translations that will assume that chapter 27, the last part of it, is Zophar. Well, I checked a few of them and I ran into one right away. And it's the Good News Translation. The Good News Translation is a Catholic version, a Protestant version, an English, and an American. In all those places, they insert a header, Zophar, in the middle of chapter 27 to indicate that what follows is Zophar's third speech and not Job. I found another translation. I think it was the Message. I'm not sure. I think that's a paraphrase. But they translated the couple of verses in 27 where he says, I'll teach you about the power of God and the ways of the Almighty I will not conceal. You've all seen it for yourselves. Why then this meaningless talk? They translate that to say, and now I am going to quote to you what you said. So they argue that Job is quoting Zophar without really agreeing with Zophar.
So they kind of provide a little commentary in the midst of the translation.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be careful with the translation, because this is a place that I'm sure is difficult. It gives people trouble. But I think, to my satisfaction, it's not a textual error. Okay.
I think that's all answered back in the beginning when we said God can give and God can take away, but He's still God.
Yeah.
That answers.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I want to make one other point. This is just a thought, an extra thought that I had before we get to chapter 28 here. The friends argue that Job punishes the wicked and that God does it swiftly in this lifetime. I want you to think, does that make sense? What kind of world would this be if God punished the wicked every time there was somebody did something wicked, they got punished for it in this life? Would that? What kind of world would that be? In kind of a strange place.
Very different from the world of hell, that's for sure.
I heard a lot of comment, but I didn't hear any of it. Understand?
It would be an empty world.
It would be an empty world because we would all be punished. But it occurred to me, if God punished the wicked, why do we need to do it? What would we need civil courts for, you know? I think God expects us to punish the wicked. I think that's the reason he ordains us to have our government, you know. Yeah. We have government that's supposed to do that. Now, government doesn't do it well always, but at least we accept the responsibility for making people pay for their crimes, don't we? So it's kind of foolish to say God. If God does it, then I don't have to do it. I'm just watch what happens. You know, it doesn't work. World doesn't work that way.
This starts out with parents. If you think about it, parents are supposed to pass judgment on the kids and discipline them and all the things you're supposed to do to bring them up. Mm-hmm. So you start there, and if that's done, then they're probably a little better people in society. And then they don't have to do as much on the government level about disciplining people because they violate laws and stuff.
Right. Sometimes our laws are unjust, and sometimes our administration of those laws are unjust. But still, God expects us to do it. And so, why should we blame Him if He doesn't do it? You know, that's our responsibility in this life, on this earth. Okay, we're ready to move on. The debate is over. And Job has won the debate. We're ready to read chapter 28. Chapter 28 is a beautiful poem about wisdom. And you remember when we got to 14, I said it was a poem about man's hard life on earth. And both chapter 14 and 28 can stand alone. You can pull them out and read them and appreciate them without the context of the rest of the book. A beautiful poetry, okay? Some people say, well, these are inserts. Somebody just stuck them in there. Well, I don't think that's the case. I think they're there for a good reason, and particularly 28 is there. Of course, there's a lot in 14 also, but it doesn't break the continuity of the text if you pull them out and read them by themselves, but they do contribute, I think, I think they're relevant to the book. And I have a possible explanation for that. But let's read 28. Can I get somebody or a couple of readers to read chapter 28 for us. Charlie, you read it? Read the whole thing? Or half of it? Somebody else? Okay, you read the other half. Read down to about, Charlie, if you read 11, 1 to 11, and then you finish the can we do that? 1 to 11 and 12 to 28.
There's a mine for silver in a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to the darkness. He searches the farthest recesses for ore in the blackest darkness. Far from where people dwell, he cuts a shaft in places forgotten by the foot of man. Far from men, he dangles and sways. The earth from which food comes is transformed below as by fire. Sapphires come from its rocks, and its dust contains nuggets of gold. No bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion prowls there. Man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains. He tunnels through the rock. His eyes see all its treasures. He searches all the sources of the rivers and brings hidden things to light. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth that cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep say, it is not in me. The sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. It cannot be bought with the gold of Ophir, with precious onyx or sapphire. Neither gold nor crystal can compare with it, nor can it be had for jewels of gold. Coral and jasper are not worthy of mention.
You're good. Keep going.
The price of wisdom is beyond rubies. The topaz of Kush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rains and a path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. And he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding.
Okay. Now, I remember the first time I read this, it was in the King James Version of 1977, I think. And I thought, what in the world is he talking about in the first part of this chapter here? You know, because he's been talking about what God does to the wicked, and suddenly he's talking about a mining operation, you know? And I thought, what is going on here? What is he talking about? But this beautiful description of a mining, you know, they dig a tunnel, they put an end to darkness, they take lights, torches down there, it talks about them swaying on scaffolding as they search throughout, you know, they're searching for treasures. Man goes to great lengths to find gold and precious stones, but he doesn't have a clue about wisdom, which is worth far more than the gold you can dig out of the ground. And that's his point. Sometimes these guys will start talking, and they'll go on and on and on, and you say, what point is he trying to make here? Yeah. You know, finally he gets to his point in verse 12, you know, where can wisdom be found? So, but it's a beautiful description of how difficulties man will put up with to try to find something worth something, you know, a precious stone or something, a rock, you know. I'm reminded of Proverbs. You know, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes in places personifies wisdom. Talks about the value of wisdom. He says, where does it come from? Well, it's hidden from everything. Man doesn't fully understand wisdom. I like verse 22 here. He says, death and destruction say, only a rumor of it has reached our ears. I like that because there's no commonality, there's no connection between death and destruction on the one hand and God's wisdom on the other, is there? So, but I like that personification. They're saying, we hadn't heard anything but a rumor of wisdom where we are, you know. And it's concealed from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air, he says. So, but it concludes with the 28th verse. He says, the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. If you think about it, that's exactly what Job was doing in chapter 1 and 2. You know, that's exactly what he was described by the author in the first part of the poem, you know. Job was a man who feared God and shunned evil. So we could say that Job was a wise man.
When they say, turn away from evil, is understanding what? That
I think it's the understanding that God wants us to have. Okay? And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. There's a difference between knowledge and understanding. Wisdom and understanding are related very closely. You can be full of knowledge. You can have all kind of knowledge and not be wise. And I've worked with people like that. You know, another point I want to make: we're all humans. We can be very wise in one area of our life and very foolish in another area, can't we? I've known guys that are extremely sharp technical engineers that are not very wise, you know, dumb as a post when it comes to human relationships or something, you know. So wisdom is not there's not an all-inclusive wisdom. But here we're talking about God's wisdom, the wisdom that God wants us to have. I think that's what we're after here.
Well, if I may comment, I'm just reflecting on the shun evil is understanding. It's not understanding some other point. It's understanding that shunning evil is the best thing to do. It's involved in that. That's not all the understanding of God and the universe. Mm-hmm. But if you do that, then you have some understanding. Mm-hmm. If you shun evil, because these are going after all the things that they can find and doing it by practicing evil, they don't have wisdom.
Right. Yeah. So, I wanted to first let me ask this question, or answer this question: why is this here? Why all of a sudden he's just been talking about what God does to the wicked, and he's been arguing with his friends, and then here's this discourse on wisdom? I thought about it. If you check wisdom and references to the wise in the whole poem, I found that get ahead of myself in my notes. Wisdom is referred to 23 times in the book, and the wise appears 10 times. So you could argue that the poem is really a debate about what is God's wisdom? Because the friends say we're wise because we know what God's doing. And Job says, no, you're not wise. So I think that's a reason for this dissertation on wisdom at this point in the poem. Eliphaz says and I'll just quickly go over these. Chapter 4, verse 21, Eliphaz basically says, Job, you have no wisdom. Zophar in chapter 11 said he wishes God would show Job some wisdom. In chapter 15, verse 2 and following, Eliphaz accuses him of thinking he has a monopoly on wisdom. But he says those who are wise are on their side, on the friend's side in the debate. So, but Job has been very sarcastic with them about their wisdom, you know. If you look in, let me do this quickly, chapter 12, I love this. He says, doubtless you're the people and wisdom will die with you. I love that.
Makes you think of Paul. That's what he did in, he did that in one of the epistles.
And yet chapter 13, verse 5, he says, if only you would be altogether silent, for you that would be wisdom. And then in 17, verse 10, he says, come on, all of you, try again. I'll not find a wise man among you. So he's very certain that there's no wisdom in what they're saying, you know. And then he comes back, chapter 26. What does he say there? Verses 2 to 4. I like this. He says, how you have helped the powerless. How you have saved the arm that is feeble. What advice you have offered to one without wisdom. So, I love his sarcasm.
I don't think these four people are going to be friends after this.
Well, yeah, God wants Job to, he wants him to offer sacrifices and Job to pray for him, so you have to conclude that their relationship is restored somewhat.
Well, so God didn't consider him irredeemable. I mean, if he wanted Job to pray for them, I don't think he would have bothered if he didn't care about
him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, you know, it's amazing to me, talking about forgiveness after this kind of bitter debate and restoring relationships. If you look at Joseph and his brothers, you know, they sold him into slavery. Mm-hmm. And he forgave them, you know. And I think he saw their repentance when they didn't know he could understand them. But and he had an easier time forgiving them than they did accepting it. They just couldn't believe that he had forgiven them, you know. So, but there's a lot of stories in the scripture about broken relationships being restored, and that's I love those stories. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just talking to myself.
Talking to yourself. Well, you can do that.
William, I think there's a lesson here. It's very easy sometimes. I mean, obviously these friends cared about him, or they wouldn't even bother to show up and try to talk to him. So, but it's very easy to make a situation worse.
That's right.
As a friend, and think you're helping when you're really not.
That's right. And that's
so
one of the lessons I want us to get out of the book. And I've got the last lesson I teach in here is things to learn from the book of Job. And one of the things we learn is how not to try to comfort your friends when they're suffering, you know, because they do a horrible job of it. True friends, but not very effective in their friendship.
But don't you think we have to learn that? I can think back years ago when I used to go to the funeral home or something. I just, you know, I felt like I was supposed to say something. But as you grow and mature and learn from people in the Bible, you overcome that.
Yeah, and I have something that I was doing for a while when somebody lost a loved one and went to death, you know. I would send them a quote from The Bridge Over St. Louis Ray. Mm-hmm. It's a short novel about a bridge that fell in South America, and this monk sees these people perish, and so he's goes on a life study to find out why God chose those people to die at that time. He was about to cross the bridge himself when it fell. The book concludes, I forgot who wrote it, Thornton Wilder? Mm-hmm. I think Thornton Wilder wrote the book. The book concludes with a quote that's become pretty famous. It says, there is a land of the living and a land of the dead, and the bridge is love. And that's the only thing, basically, that's the only thing that matters. That's the quote from the book. And I was sharing that with people because I thought they could get some comfort from it. sometimes they don't. You know, they're not comforted by that at all. They want their deceased person not to be in the land of the living, you know, in the dead. They say they're in the land of the living now, and we're still in the land of the dead. You know, so you can try and mess up. But there's another. I love that it's in Isaiah about 49, I think, where it says, "Precious is the death of the saints to the Lord." That's one that I find comfort in. And another one that I find comfort in is when David, you know, he lost his son to Bathsheba's boy, dead son died on him, and he said, "I will go to him. He can't come to me, but I will go to him." I think that comforts me.
Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah, we can say the wrong thing and not intend to at all.
And I think losing someone that's close to us in our family, we can learn that way also, what is comforting and what isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've always heard it said, the best thing is your presence.
That's right.
Yeah, your presence is the best thing you do. So that's one of the lessons that I want us to get from the book. But I said, why is this chapter here? I think Job is saying once and for all what God's wisdom is and is not. He's saying, you guys don't have wisdom. And I had something I wanted to share with you here. Let me see if I can find it. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar say wisdom is knowing why God does what he does and knowing how God deals with the wicked. To them, that's wisdom. Job says, no, that's not wisdom, and they don't have, you know, they don't know why God's doing what he's doing. So Job is, he's settling once and for all what God's wisdom is and who has it and who does not have it. And I think he makes two points in this chapter. God alone has a full understanding of wisdom. He says that in verse 23. We do not have the wisdom to fully understand why God does what he does. And I think he says that. His second point is, God has revealed to us all we need to know. In any situation, fear God and avoid evil. And that's the wisdom you need.
I can see why God is upset with the three, because they're arrogant. They're saying, I know what God's doing. Yeah. You don't. And God says, no, you don't know what I'm doing.
And I have seen very famous televangelists on TV do the same thing. You know, and I know how God's good. How he's punishing those people. You don't know that. You know, it's not good theology. Okay. I wanted to share something with you from Packer. I don't know how many of you have ever read Packer. This is a pretty old book, but Janice and I read it. Let me find my place here. This is on a chapter called God's Wisdom in Ours. Let's see if we can find it here.
Now, is that hours like time or hours?
Our wisdom.
Okay.
He says, Packer says a lot of people go wrong when he's talking about when they think they understand God's wisdom. He says, he gives this illustration to make you understand it. He says, if you stand at the end of a platform on York Station, you can watch a constant succession of engine and train movement, which, if you're a railroad enthusiast, would greatly fascinate you. But you will only be able to form a very rough and general idea of the overall plan in terms of which all these movements are being determined and the operational pattern set out by the working timetable. And so it says, if, however, you're privileged enough to be taken by one of the higher-ups into the magnificent electrical signal box that lies athwart platform 7 and 8, you will see on the longest wall, a diagram of the entire track layout for 5 miles on either side of the station. with little glowworm lights moving or stationary on the different tracks to show the signalman at a glance exactly where every train and engine is. At once you'll be able to look at the whole situation through the eyes of the men who control it. You will see from the diagram why it was that this train had to be signaled to a halt. That one was diverted from its normal running line. That one was parked temporarily on the side. He says, now the mistake that is commonly made is to suppose that this is an illustration of what God does when he bestows wisdom. To suppose, in other words, that the gift of wisdom consists in deepening understanding into the providential meaning and purpose of events going on around us. An ability to see why God has done what he's done in a particular case. What he's going to do next. And people feel that if they are really walking close to God so that he could impart wisdom to them freely, then they would, so to speak, find themselves in the signal box. Okay? They would discern the real purpose of everything that's happened to them, and it would be clear to them every moment how God is making all things work together for good. So we want to understand all the workings of God. We think that would be wise if we had that. He said Christians who think that way suffer a great deal because they're constantly trying to understand why God's doing what he's doing in their life and constantly being frustrated and constantly convinced that since they don't understand it, they must not be very spiritual, so they condemn themselves, you know. He explains what wisdom is contrary to that. He says, we ask again what it means for God to give us wisdom. What kind of gift is it? If another transport illustration may be permitted, it is like being taught to drive. What matters in driving is the speed and the appropriateness of your reactions to things, and the soundness of your judgment as to what scope a situation gives you. You do not ask yourself why the road should narrow or screw itself into a dog leg wiggle just where it does, or why that van should be parked where it is, or why the lady or the gentleman in front should hug the crown of the road so lovingly. You simply try to see and do the right thing in the actual situation that presents itself. The effect of divine wisdom is to enable you and me to do just that in the actual situations of everyday life. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I read that fast and I'm a choppy reader. But Janice and I both read this sometime, probably early 2000s, late 1900s. But Janice wrote in the margin here a summation. I could have just read this and probably been done with it. She wrote, having wisdom is not knowing what God is doing, but knowing what you are to do because you know him. So that's wisdom. Okay. And I think that's what this chapter says. Fear God and shun evil. Okay.
You ready for this?
Just about. I got to make sure I got everything
I'm saying. I'm just trying to hold the place.
You raised it for me, she said.
Okay, and I think you'll find if you read Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, you'll find the same. They agree with this. So, anybody got a comment? Have I confused everybody? Read what Erdman says about 28.
Job's mind turns again to the question of wisdom. It says, see 26:14. This is the heart of his problem, how to understand the inscrutable ways of God. But no miner can uncover a vein of wisdom. All the wealth in the world will not buy it. Only God knows where to find it. And man becomes wise through reverence for God and by rejecting evil.
Okay. All right. So we're ready to go to chapter 29. Tim, would you read that?
Sure. Job continues his discourse. How long for the months gone by, for the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone on my head and his light, and by his light I walked through darkness. Oh, for the days when I was in my prime, when God's intimate friendship blessed my house, when the Almighty was still with me and my children were around me. When my path was drenched with cream and the rock poured out for me streams of olive oil. When I went to the gate of the city and took my seat in the public square, the young men saw me and stepped aside. The old men rose to their feet. The chief men refrained from speaking and covered their mouths with their hands. The voices of the nobles were hushed and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths. Whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me, because I rescued the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to assist them. The one who was dying blessed me. I made the widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was father to the needy. I took up the case of the stranger. I broke the fangs of the wicked and snatched the victims from their teeth. I thought, I will die in my own house, my days as numerous as the grains of sand. My roots will reach to the water, and the dew will lie all night on my branches. My glory will not fade. The bow will ever be new in my hand. The bow, in that case. People listened to me expectantly, waiting in silence for my counsel. After I spoke, they spoke no more. My words fell gently on their ears. They waited for me as for showers and drank in my words as spring rain. When I smiled at them, they scarcely believed it. The light of my face was precious to them. I chose the way for them and sat as their chief. I dwelt as a king among his troops, was like one who comforts mourners.
Okay, so this whole chapter, Job is reminiscing and regretting the loss of his former life. Okay, he was a great man, he was wealthy, he served his children, he was generous, he served the needy, he mentions the orphans, the widows, the poor. He cared for the sick and the dying, he fought injustice, he had the admiration of, and respect of everyone. He was like a king among his people. God was his intimate friend and watched over him. And he thought he would die peacefully in his home after a long life of service to God and man. But he's lost everything. So he is reminiscing what a great life he had before hard times came, right? So he longs for his former life before the suffering came to him, and he's lost not only his health, but he's lost his prestige, he's lost his respect, nobody respects him. And I like what he says in verse 18, you know, this is what he thought he would die in his home, his house, his days as numerous as the grains of sand. In other words, he thought God was going to watch over him and take care of him because he was a righteous man. So his world comes crashing down around him. The bow there, he says, my bow was ever new in my hand. The bow is a symbol of his strength, okay, his vitality. Notice in verse 5, I think it's verse 5, let's see. My children were around me. He longs for the days when his children were alive. What we're going to see is in chapter 29, he reminisces about how great a life he did have. Then in chapter 30, he's going to go back and come back to the present situation and how horribly his life is now. And in chapter 31, he's going to conclude with a lot of vows. He's going to vow to the friends and to God, he was righteous. He tried to live a righteous life. He's not a wicked man. So I hope we can get through. I think we can get through 30 today anyway. But read Erdman on 29, Janice.
Okay, 29. Job looks back on the golden days of God's favor, past enjoyment of home, of success in business, of universal respect.
Okay.
And then he says what you did, that they returned to the bitter present in 30.
Okay, chapter 30. So, I'll share in the reading if you want me to, but if somebody can read part of 30, get a volunteer. Okay, I'll let you two read it. Read down about 16, and then you finish it. You start.
But now they mock me, men younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to put with my sheepdogs. Of what use was the strength of their hands to me, since their vigor had gone from them? Hagar, haggard from want and hunger, they roamed the parched land and desolate wastelands at night. In the brush they gathered salt herbs, and their food was the root of the broom tree. They were banished from their fellow men, shouted at as if they were thieves. They were forced to live in the dry stream beds, among the rocks and in holes in the ground. They brayed among the bushes and huddled in the undergrowth. A base and nameless brood, they were driven out of the land. And now their sons mock me in song. I have become a byword among them. They detest me and keep their distance. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. Now that God has unstrung my bow and afflicted me, they throw off restraint in my presence. On my right the tribe attacks. They lay snares for my feet. They build their siege ramps against me. They break up my road. They succeed in destroying me without anyone's helping them. They advance as through a gaping breach. Amid the ruins they come rolling in. Terrors overwhelm me. My dignity is driven away as by the wind. My safety vanishes like a cloud.
And now my life ebbs away. Days of suffering grip me. Night pierces my bones. My gnawing pains never rest. In his great power, God becomes like nothing, like clothing to me. He binds me like the neck of my garment. He throws me into the mud, and I am reduced to dust and ashes. I cry out to you, O God, but you do not answer. I stand up, but you merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of your hand, you attack me. You snatch me up and drive me before the wind. You toss me about in the storm. I know you will bring me down to death, to the place appointed for all the living. Surely no one lays a hand on a broken man when he cries for help in his distress. Have I not wept for those in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? Yet when I hoped for the good, evil came. Even when I looked for light, came darkness. The churning inside me never stops. Days of suffering confront me. I go about blackened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I have become a brother of jackals, a companion of owls. My skin grows black and peels. My body burns with fever. My harp is tuned to mourning, and my flute to the sound of wailing.
Okay, so he's describing his horrible condition he's in now. You know, he's mourning. It's not just his physical suffering. He's lost his loved ones. He's humiliated. He has no dignity. He thinks he has lost God's friendship and protection, and he doesn't know why. He thinks he has nothing to look forward to but death. And he cries out to God, and God only looks at him. I noticed in verse 1, he refers to his sheepdogs. In describing these people, he says, men younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to put with my sheepdogs. That's the only reference I know in the Bible of the shepherds using dogs. So that might be an indication that he is a Gentile, you know, just for what it's worth, you know. But he goes to a long explanation of this lowlife that despises him, you know. It's several verses here to describe just how useless these people are. They're the lowest of the low, and yet they despise him and spit in his face. So
they mock him in song. I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have songs in our day and time, and sometimes they're mocking of people. Yeah. They're mocking of particular persons in history or just of a category.
Yeah, I think Jesus used that example when he was talking about the like children in the marketplace singing, we played a tune for you and you didn't dance, and we sang a dirge, and you, in other words, you're supposed to jump to the song that we sing, you know. Let me see. You're just standing up?
I just have to stretch.
That's
sorry.
Fine.
Really, I always thought that reference about we played and you didn't dance and all that. Well, like, we did these things that you're supposed to respond this certain way to.
Right.
And you didn't match convention.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't jump to their team, right?
Right. You didn't dance. Here's our team, you're supposed to dance to it. And he says, no, that's not the right team. That's not the right dance.
So, Job says he hoped for good, but evil came. And the graphic description of his suffering, his physical condition. Okay, any questions on that chapter before we've got 10 minutes. Read Erdman for that chapter.
In chapter 30, he says, but now he returns to the bitter present, which has made him the butt of all and of everything and everyone, an outcast incessantly gnawed by pain.
Okay. Now we're going to start 31. We're not going to be able to finish 31 because it's fairly long. I want to just point out a few things about it, and we're going to end maybe a little early today. I don't want to read the chapter through like we've been doing. I want to read it a section at a time. This is where he has all these vows, and I counted, I think, 16 of them in all, where he is saying, I have been a righteous man. I have tried to live a righteous life. I'm not wicked. God's not punishing me for my sin. So let's start. Somebody read, I'll read it, verse 1 through 12 here. I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. For what is man's lot from God above, his heritage from the Almighty on high? Is it not ruin for the wicked, disaster for those who do wrong? Does he not see my ways and count my every step? If I have walked in falsehood, or my foot has hurried after deceit, let God weigh me in honest scales, and he will know that I am blameless. If my steps have turned from the path, if my heart has been led by my eyes, if my hands have been defiled, then may others eat what I have sown, and may my crops be uprooted. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then may my wife grind another man's grain, and may other men sleep with her. For that would have been shameful, a sin to be judged. It is a fire that burns to destruction. It would have uprooted my harvest. So, what I want us to do when we go through these, think about what Job is describing, what to him is righteousness and living a righteous life before God. And we've said the book might have been written before the Mosaic Law was given, right? So think about this in terms of our understanding of what a righteous life is, okay? And what is, how does this correspond to the Mosaic Law? How does this correspond to the New Testament teaching about morals and ethics and a right, what's sinful and what's not sinful? So here, verse 1 reminds me of the Sermon on the Mount. made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a woman. You know, in the Old Testament law says, don't commit adultery with a woman. And Jesus says, if you look lustfully at a woman, it's a sin. And here Job is transcending the Mosaic law, isn't he? He's saying, I made a covenant with my eyes not to even look lustfully at a woman. So that goes beyond the Mosaic law. And in verse 9, he's obviously referring to adultery. That's one of the Ten Commandments. Verse 5, he mentions walking in falsehood. That's telling a lie. No, that's living. That's one of the Ten Commandments. He talks about, in verse 12, adultery being like a fire that leads to death. I believe Proverbs talks about that in detail. And notice that his reasons for shunning these things was the fear of the Lord, fear of punishment. He wanted to shun evil. And we'll notice that most of his vows start with, if I've done this, then may this bad thing happen to me. And like I said, there's about 16 of those if-then statements, these vows. And it reminds me of several places in the Old Testament, somebody wants to make sure that people can believe what they say. They say, may the Lord deal with me ever so severely if what I say to you is not true. That's several times.
I don't do so-and-so by tomorrow.
Yeah, may the Lord deal with me ever so severely. So that's what Job is saying here. He's doing this. So, verse 7 refers to yielding to temptation. You know, temptation is not a sin, but yielding to temptation is. Somebody read the 13 through 15, those three verses.
Okay. If I have denied justice to any of my servants, whether male or female, when they have grievance against me, what will I do when God confronts me? What will I answer when called to account? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both within our mother? If I have denied the desires of the poor, or let the eyes of the widow grow weary, if I have kept my bread to myself, not sharing it with the fatherless, but from my youth I reared them as a father would, and from my birth I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perishing for lack of clothing, or the needy without garments, and their hearts did not bless me for warming them with the fleece from my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless, knowing that I had influence in court, and let my arm fall from the shoulder, let it be broken off at the joint. For I dreaded destruction from God, and for the fear of his splendor I could not do such things. If I have put my trust in gold, or said to pure gold, you are my security. If I have rejoiced over my great wealth, the fortune my hands had gained. If I have regarded the sun in its radiance, or the moon moving in splendor, so that my heart was secretly enticed, and my heart offered them a kiss of homage, then there also would be sins to be judged, for I would have been unfaithful to God on high. If I have rejoiced at my enemy's misfortune, or gloated over the troubles that came to him, I have not allowed my mouth to sin by invoking a curse against their lives. If those of my household have never said, who has not been filled with Job's meat, but no stranger had to spend the night in the street, for my door was always open to the traveler. I have concealed my sin as people do, by hiding my guilt in my heart, because I so feared the crowd and so dreaded the contempt of the clans that I kept silent and would not go outside. Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing. Surely I would wear it on my shoulder. I would put it on like a crown. I would give him an account of my every step. I would present it to him as to a ruler. If my land cries out against me and all its furrows are wet with tears, if I have devoured its yield without payment or broken the spirit of the tenants, then let briars come up instead of wheat and sinkweed instead of barley. The words of Job are ended.
Okay, so he makes a lot of vows there, and we're about out of time, so I want us to come back and go over those one at a time and look at, is this in the New Testament? Is this in the Old Testament? How do I do as an individual? Can I claim these things in my life? You know, and we'll see some change. Like he says, strangers, you know, it was a custom in the Old Testament. So a traveler comes to your town, he would go to the center of the square, and if you were able, you were supposed to take him in. Now, they didn't have motels and things like that. So it would have been a sin not to do that. Well, we don't have that today, but, you know. We'll talk about it some more. We're out of time now. But we'll finish chapter 31, or 31, and then we're going to finally get to Elihu. And I love Elihu. We'll spend some time next week with him. So I appreciate it. Time's up.